Hi there. Welcome back to the Change Manifesto podcast. I'm your host, Molly Angel. As always, the mission of this series is to empower individuals and businesses to liberate themselves from change resistance and effortlessly ignite change. Last time, we talked about the very first step you need to take before beginning any change initiative: learning your change capacity. The easiest way to do this, if you remember, is by looking backwards at past projects and conducting a change audit. If you missed that episode, jump back and have a listen, as conducting an honest, no-nonsense change capability assessment is the foundation for everything that follows, which we'll be talking about today. And just like with any transformational change, you don't want to start off on the wrong foot. If you've been following along these last couple of episodes, you may be feeling like we've been pulling concepts out from thin air. But don't worry, that's all part of the process. Often in the course of my work, I imagine myself poised cross-legged on a yoga pillow, plucking ideas out of the ether and weaving them together into a complex and robust tapestry. At least, that's the go-to visual my brain paints from the feeling I stir up when I'm in the thick of a change management project. For the sake of my own flow, let's just roll with it. Can you see it? Last episode, we wrapped up our discussion on learning change capacity with a story example of a situation where this was not done or understood ahead of time, to the detriment of all involved. At least that is, until the team was able to take a step back, clear the air by acknowledging the situation, and give it another go. This episode, we're going to talk about how, after completing a change capability assessment, you can start actually using these tools to surface change resistance. Shall we jump right in? Since we ended last episode on a never waste a crisis example, I thought we'd start this episode with an anecdote from a career leader in change management and organizational transformation and one of our regular series guests, Claire Garretts. A little setup. Claire, who boasts a 40-year career as a leader in change management, started working in the field long before there was a name for it. But it wasn't until after grad school, in what she called her first real professional job, that she experienced firsthand the full power of the process.
I was converting a dental practice from paper records to computer system, and this was, you know, many years ago. So it was pretty radical at the time, and the office manager didn't want to do it. She felt like she was being betrayed by the dentist.
Change managers and transformation experts see this kind of response to change a lot, and most of the time it's rooted in the lack of understanding. In this case, the office manager, who was extremely loyal to her employer, expected a level of loyalty in return that she felt she wasn't getting. She perceived this change initiative, which she did not understand, as a burden that was hoisted upon her. It shook up her day-to-day work life and, in her eyes, completely redefined a role she'd come to master without reason or explanation. It wasn't until this moment that Claire, in her words, really got the bug. Our resident professor, Ed West, who teaches future healthcare executives in the University of Washington Masters of Health Administration program, says this is a very common reaction by people involved in large-scale change initiatives. It's particularly those on the front line of that change, he says, who are most drastically affected by it.
And so when you're introducing something, you're adding more steps to the different reporting that they have to do.
And people, he says, and I quote, get quite upset with that. One example that came to mind for Ed perfectly exemplifies the potential panic a mismanaged project can breed. At the time, he worked for a healthcare organization in the Health Intelligence Department within IT. He was part of a group responsible for developing the applications that the organization used for pretty much everything, from data analytics to warehousing to cloud computing. The company decided to switch from one application to another, and the transition was, according to Ed, not handled smoothly at all. To make matters worse, the team relied on this application to manage all of their projects day to day.
They first announced a couple months ahead of time that the switch was coming, but then didn't really follow up with enough training and education until like the last possible moment to help people understand how to use a tool and switch it. The other thing that didn't happen or occur was that folks didn't have a say in terms of what their needs were.
So when the organization turned on the new app and switched off the old one, the team wasn't able to manage any of their daily tasks and productivity plummeted. What happened next? According to Ed, people just started ignoring the tool altogether and found their own ways to cope with their new reality ad hoc.
What ended up happening, at least halfway through, or a few months outside the goal I date, was people were not using the tool. They were managing their projects either in Excel or another database or SharePoint. Change happened, but the outcome that was expected didn't happen. So it got worse.
This is the kind of change management mishap that instills a lack of trust in the targets of that change, those people most affected in the day-to-day. This begs the question, is resistance really the greatest psychological hurdle most change initiatives face? Here's Claire again. More often, this resistance is rooted in a lack of understanding for the why and the how of the change. It's all about the unknowns that crop up and multiply, often exponentially in a state of panic, on the front line of the project. Here comes good old trauma, mucking up the works again. In the case of Claire's dental office manager, what she didn't know was that the dentist was planning to sell his practice. He wanted to make the conversion from paper to digital because he thought it would make his business a more appealing sale to a younger doctor just starting out. The office manager's job was safe, but of course, that wasn't how she felt when faced with a seemingly abrupt transition.
So when I showed up to implement the system with her, office was closed and she and I were going to be working all day and I was going to convert all the records and train her and stuff. She told me that she was quitting and she wanted me to help her write her letter of resignation. And wow. I was like, oh my God, he was going to freak out if he found that out.
In a situation like this, where the technical process change is going to be followed by an even more fundamental changing of the guard leadership, retaining existing staff to manage all those transitions is even more paramount. It's what holds the practice together through the cascade of upcoming change. Frankly, the retiring dentist needed his office manager then more than ever. And as you can imagine, emotions were extremely high. It's moments like these that have the potential to lead to fits of what I have come to lovingly term crying in the bathroom. Ed explains it like this.
The barriers that you run into when it comes to, you know, leading change in the organization or even leading change in your life, right, is running into, you know, that first difficult moment that doesn't feel right, where you doubt yourself, you doubt whether this is the right thing, you're uncomfortable, and people just don't know how to deal with those emotions and manage through it.
It's the job of a change manager to help organizations come to a point where change is not such a traumatic event. While the individual solutions will vary based on the particular circumstances of each change initiative, a good manager understands that having empathy is a universal and non-negotiable component. Back to our dental office manager. For Claire, this was a leveling up point in her own career development. She already had several years of experience in private practice, so thinking on her feet and capitalizing on her existing knowledge base, she listened to her traumatized office manager and then she made a pitch.
She was crying and we were going through pretty tough stuff here. And I finally said, look, give me 90 days. Just agree to try this for 90 days.
In that time, Claire communicated that she would arrange a sit-down with the dentist to clear the miscommunication between them and heavily invest in training her on the new computer system so she too could level up her skill set and feel confident in her new abilities. And after 90 days, they would meet to reevaluate the situation. Claire said to the woman,
let's, you know, just give it your old, good old college try for 90 days. And if at that time you really want out, then I not only will help you write your letter of resignation, but I'll help you find another job because, you know, I know all these people.
I'll bet you can already guess where this is going. After a matter of weeks, Claire and the office manager succeeded in completely mitigating her trauma, and the results were astounding.
She was like a totally different person. She was like you know, king of the walk. It turned out that she was the only person in her family or social circle who had even touched a computer at that point. And so her social status went through the roof. And because she was smart and capable, she took to the computer like nobody's business. And she was a great success. And if I'd tried to take that computer away from her, I think she would have fought me.
This experience served as a pivotal turning point for both women and awarded them each enough experience points to catapult them forward in their careers.
What I found out in that process was that you can find a way for people if you help them through it, and there's going to be something in it for them. You just don't know what it is. And for her, it was really helping the doctor, because she was very loyal to him, which is why her heart was broken. She thought he was being disloyal to her. But anyway, her loyalty came out. She served him well. And in the process, she found out some things about herself that she didn't know. And she was like so happy. It was just, and I realized, I love this. I can do this. This is great work.
That office manager discovered that she had a much greater capacity for change than she had initially believed. Claire, in turn, discovered her calling. Remember earlier when I said that it wasn't just about communication and training? This example reinforces that notion. Yes, communication and training are important cogs in the change management machine. But the juice that keeps the whole thing running is authentic resonance. Claire listened to the office manager, came up with a solution catered to meet those needs, and the result was one that rang true with all parties and kept the practice in smooth sailing through the transitional phase. So how do you become like Claire? Think on your feet and surface resistance to help facilitate seamless change. You may want to grab a pen and paper for this next segment. All right, yogis, time to pluck some of these concepts out of the ether and actually start applying them in real life. There are a couple of quick tools you can start using right now that will help you grow your emotional intelligence, both as a person and as a change manager. The first concept I want to talk about is an AIM concept called Frame of Reference Messaging. We talked about AIM back in episode 1. It stands for Accelerating Implementation Methodology, and it's the primary framework I use as the basis for my own work. If this isn't ringing any bells, now might be a good time to pause, go back, and revisit this episode. With frame of reference messaging, you will be able to reach each of your change targets, those people affected by and most often resistant to change, where they live. In order to understand their position and find viable solutions, you must be able to observe and assess their perspective on the change from their unique point of view. This will allow you to understand their specific resistance and the "what's in it for me," which is, as we've learned by now, carries a lot of currency when it comes to getting targets to embrace change. The best place to start is with observation, because this is where the real relevant and resonant revelations are hiding. If you are familiar with the world of user experience design, then you know that users very often have no idea what they want or why. And you'll mine far better data if you observe their behaviors and take notes rather than ask them their opinions point blank or make assumptions based on this limited scope. Remember this: once you start making assumptions, you're losing the really rich information of why people do what they do. We'll call this concept epistemic contextualism. I won't get too deep into defining this now. We'll talk more about it in future episodes. For now, the main thing to remember is that inductive reasoning is far more valuable than the deductive. One quick, easy, and low-fidelity way to gather some observational data is the use of the PAIR method. PAIR stands for People, Environment, Artifacts, and Relationships. To gather data using this method, take a blank piece of paper, draw two lines through it so that it's divided into four quadrants, then label each quadrant to its corresponding letter. Once you identify your change targets, start jotting down notes in the first two quadrants, people and environment. These can be anything. Is it noisy? Are team members constantly fighting a rogue printer? Nothing is too small for this observation technique. Almost every project I've ever worked on uncovers some complete gem of an idea or an unknown problem that needs to be addressed immediately using this simple tool. Once you start to get the hang of it, move on to the next two quadrants. Artifacts is where you'll note what tools the people are using and how they use them and how often. Do they use them for their intended purpose or to fill some other unsolved need? In the relationships quadrant, take note of how the team and stakeholders interact with one another. Who's handing things off to whom? Who's depending on who? Pretty simple, right? By the end of this exercise, you'll have a thorough document full of rich information that will help you see things and solve things from each target's unique point of view. And once you can identify their frame of reference, you can craft why, what's in it for me, messaging targeted specifically to them. And as we know, if it resonates for them, it will motivate them to let go of their resistance and bolster the change themselves.
There isn't just one message.
As Claire so succinctly put it, effective change managers must learn to pay attention and speak to the audience that they're trying to influence. For example, a finance person will have an entirely different point of view from a data analyst. They might be more concerned with the bottom line, whereas the analyst might be more preoccupied with data migration.
If you're speaking to an accountant, you want that person to listen to you, then you want to say certain things or ask certain kinds of questions. But if you're speaking to, a gardener, it's probably different. So have an appreciation and an awareness for that. Because if you do that, then you can navigate through all different kinds of groups. And that's how you learn things. And then you become almost like what they used to call it, bard. You go from camp to camp, and maybe you're a diplomat. You go from camp to camp, and you understand things, and you can translate that language into something that someone else can hear.
I'll say it again. Reach each target precisely where they live. While they may share the same process change, their frames of reference are entirely different. Catering to each individually allows you to create a key role map, analyzing all teams and individuals affected by the change in light of the impact the change will have on them. While it's always ideal to build your frame of reference at the start of a change initiative, these techniques are still effective when used to mitigate the damage of a poorly executed change. Remember Ed's example from earlier about the not-so-smooth new application introduction? Well, with zero compliance and the entire team decentralized and disorganized, the organization faced an even bigger hurdle than before. They had no choice but to implement some accountability after the fact.
We started doing audits on a weekly basis. We established, okay, these are the things that every project should have in ServiceNow. Here are the columns that you fill in, et cetera, et cetera. We did it every week and worked with the managers to make sure. So we did a process. So we put into place some structures and some tools and an action plan to help guide people to hold them accountable to learn it. The other thing that we did is that provided training courses as well as accessibility to super users on a regular basis. So people, if they got stuck, instead of losing productivity and going to what they know, they could reach out to someone and ask that question quick. The third thing that we did that was critical was listen to what their needs are and how they use the tool and then adjust or make changes to the tool to adapt and fit our organization and the way we do projects.
And while it took some time, some rework, and a lot of heavy lifting, they did refocus on the why of it all and eventually reach full compliance with the new tool. Still, with proper change management right at the beginning, they would have avoided quite a bit of trauma and lost ROI. We've covered quite a bit today, but I want to emphasize my final point just one more time because it's just that important. Change management is the vehicle that moves people through change. But in order to do that effectively, you must dissuade their fears and surface the resistance. And the key to that is a resonant answer to the age-old question of, but why? If you give this why a personal anchor to tether them through their change journey, as in life, you'll no longer feel like you're being swept away by the tides. Next episode, we'll be digging into the various stakeholders involved in a change project and what each of their roles are. By the end of the episode, you'll have a framework for beginning to assemble your change team, including how to select a change agent and empower them to lead and inspire change among their peers. This is Molly Angel once again, signing off. As always, until next time, just remember, it doesn't matter if you want to go by wagon train or rocket ship, I can help you with change.